What's up, Energy fam? Welcome back to another episode of Wicked Energy with JG, the place where energy, economics, and innovation converge. I'm your host, Justin Gauthier, coming to you live from the vibrant city of Houston, Texas. As someone who spent years immersed in the oilfield service sector and focusing on energy economics and drilling operations, each week we dive into the heart of the energy sector, exploring its trends, challenges, and the future of energy in our lives. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back. I'm here with my man, Ian Myers, one of the founders of Mainline Ventures. Man, I'm excited to kick this thing off. I'm teaming up with Mainline Ventures to create a six-part series of episodes focused on the strategic framework for business negotiations. So in this first episode, what we're going to do is just give a general overview of Mainline Ventures. You know, I had you guys on the show not too long ago, but this is kind of when you were first getting kicked off. But you've really owned in on your message, who you're really targeting, and how you're adding like just a tremendous amount of value to companies, right? Whether it's, I mean, it can be any company. But, you know, with my audience mainly being in oil and gas, and that's where you come from, you know, I think it's important. And so, you know, what we're going to do is we'll kind of go over your guys' process that makes up the entirety of the framework. And then we'll follow up each episode by breaking down each step for some actionable takeaways that can be used in your business. And so for the folks out there, if you don't know Ian and Keith, I suggest you go back to episode 63. It basically goes into your guys' history, where you're from, your education, who you've worked with. But real quick, Ian, if you would, I'd love for you to just give a high-level overview of, you know, who you are, where you're from, where you've worked, and then we'll get into the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, man, I appreciate you having me back on. Name's Ian Myers. I grew up in central, rural, Amish country, Pennsylvania, what we like to call Pennsyltucky. Went to Penn State, studied petroleum engineering, really for two reasons. One, I was a poor kid. They gave me a scholarship to do so. And then two is right around the time There Will Be Blood came out. And I remember watching that movie and like, I want to be an oil man like that and start my own thing.
No way, I didn't know that.
Yeah. No, it's true. So I went out of school to work at ExxonMobil, drilling and completions, did a lot of really cool things, deep water Gulf of Mexico, offshore California, some West Texas, some Angola. And then, you know, everyone at Exxon kind of hits a three-year mark and decides, am I going to stay here for, you know, forever and be a corporate company guy, or am I going to go do something entrepreneurial? I wanted to do something more entrepreneurial. I kind of took bigger roles at smaller companies, which really culminated with me starting Clear Creek Resource Partners, a PE-backed DJ Basin operator back in 2017. That was the first time me and Keith, my younger brother, worked together. I loved working together. I loved building that out. Went and got my MBA at Northwestern, Kellogg School of Management. And then really when Clear Creek wrapped up in 2021, had a unique opportunity to go work for a boutique consulting firm focused in negotiations, and saw kind of all different industries, company sizes, procurement teams, sales teams, M&As. And Keith came over there as well. We kind of built out the implementation arm, and you know, then felt like we wanted to launch Mainline Ventures, which is kind of bringing both those experiences to bear. Oil and gas executive experience. Keith has been on the OFS side, so he has experience at a high level there. And then, you know, kind of all these skills we learned in negotiation that we felt like could help in the oil and gas, alternative energy, industrial space.
Nice. I love it. And so what exactly, like, how would you package what you guys do? Like, what is the crux of your offering?
Yeah, so I would say it's a simplistic playbook that we can implement with minimal intervention. And what do I mean by that? I mean, companies are feeling more pressure. Sales teams are feeling more pressure than ever to hit their sales metrics, to hit their numbers, to hit their growth targets. And right now, the only interventions they have sometimes are maybe you do a sales summit, maybe you bring in some training, which is kind of just the same rehash type of training. Maybe you bring in a new leader or a new CRM tool. And our process is, no, the missing piece is negotiation science, connecting your strategy to your commercial offering. And we can come in with a very succinct playbook, work with your people, work with your process, and help you get more at the deal table, help you get higher conversion. We do the same thing with procurement groups. We do the same thing on M&A. We do the same thing, frankly, in personal negotiations. So it's founded in science. It's really a simple playbook, minimal intervention, to help our clients get more. That's kind of the quick elevator pitch.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes sense. And to your point, I mean, I've been involved with different sales trainings and stuff like that. And you may get some like little sort of template style strategies or things like that. But in our day and age, and again, being in the OFS side of it, it's so much different than just going out beating the streets and landing a sale. Like there's so much psychology and consultative selling and negotiations that go into it that on our side of the table, we really don't get much training on. So again, when you and I have talked a lot and I've seen what you guys offer, you even came into AES and did some work for us, which was, again, a huge, huge step forward in the way we look at deal making and structuring, pricing, looking at how to create leverage for win-win situations for the clients. So again, I think like something like this doesn't exist in our space. You can go out and hire some, you know, a consulting company, but there's 99.9% of the folks that you're dealing with, A, haven't been on the operator side, B, haven't been on the OFS side, C, have just not that real life experience that you can actually be related, that you can relate to. And so that's where I think you guys have found like a really neat space that ultimately can be applied in so many different industries. But at the end of the day, you know, the low hanging fruit is obviously oil and gas. I mean, you guys have been go ahead.
Oh, no. The one thing I'll add, just to kind of, I totally agree with what you say. The one thing I think is unique in our training and that we've probably even revised since we met with you and your team was, you know, we'll come in, we'll work, and we'll audit the sales team ahead of it and kind of understand the particulars of their business. So, and we build all the content around that audit. So it's very customized. And I think the coolest thing now is we say every attendee bring a deal you're working on, or maybe it's a deal that in the past 3 months you couldn't close, like how would you do an after action on it? Bring it in, we'll do a training, we'll work in the training. And nowadays we're like handing folks actual, like what we call deal books or playbooks of for each attendee, here's how you take what we're teaching and go apply it to your deal. And that just has so much better conversion and uptake because we're applying it to their specific situation and they can take it and scale it after that.
Gotcha. No, and I want to go over sort of your guys' strategic framework that you've developed and break it down a little bit. But before that, our good friend Jeremy Funk over at Funk Futures came out with a post. It sounds like you guys have a bit of a strategic partnership going on there. What's that about?
Yeah, no. So I think Jeremy is someone who I think you actually introduced me to when we got going. You know, I think he put it in his post and I would echo the same sentiment. There are people that you meet and you instantly click with. I think the three of us are all like very authentic guys that kind of, you know, we are who we are. And Jeremy is that, you know, to a T. And I think instantly got it, you know, we connected on that.
Yeah.
I think where we found there to be this partnership is Jeremy is so good on the execution, getting in, selling in really complex technical offerings. And it just seemed like a natural pairing for what we do that's more strategic. Like, how do we position your company? How do we think about the execution tools, what you're going to take in to pitch the deal? And then work with a team like Jeremy, who takes that material and actually goes and closes the work. And so it's exciting, it's new, but that's kind of the vision of it, is it's a full suite of services. So you not only get the contract sales arm with Jeremy, but you get Keith and me helping you do strategy, thinking about how to position your offering, thinking about how to close bigger deals, negotiate better when you get there. And so we're super excited about it. Really like Jeremy, can't say enough things about Hemp and Funk Futures. And I mean, their story has been awesome. So I'm a big fan and excited about the partnership.
That is super cool, man. Again, it's neat when you see different companies collaborate and join forces, because I mean, it just increases the surface area for more opportunity. And if we can help each other in the space, even better, right? So it's so cool to see. So let's get into it. So before we get into it, what is the purpose behind, and you've kind of mentioned it, but kind of at the core, what's the purpose behind the framework for business negotiations?
Yeah, I think folks hear negotiations and they instantly think of money or the last little bit of the deal table getting it closed. Really, from our viewpoint and how we've been trained in it, is it's really connecting your strategy to your commercial offering. Like your corporate strategic investments, the things you do, like buying a mud plant at a specific location, investing in a new technology, investing in an analytics platform, all, you know, any company in the OF space has these differentiated investments, differentiators. Negotiation is about connecting that so it comes through with maximal leverage, and you can close more deals on it. And so the framework is really a very simplistic process of doing that, of taking your strategy and connecting it to your sales offering. And so it's just a step-by-step playbook that does it for each particular customer type that you're interacting with on the sales side. We do the same thing on procurement side with their suppliers. And so it's really just a playbook, a step-by-step guide. And what we see time and time again is if we can work with one client and take them through the playbook once, they can take the playbook and use it for every deal after that. And that's something I think when Keith and me started Mainline, we really wanted to, I think what enables us to do on the firm side is be really clear on what ROI we bring, because we're helping convert more deals. So we come in, help you with this deal. You can see what the return on it was or not. And then we're not there to, like a lot of your more traditional boutique consulting firms, we're not there trying to get the next engagement. My goal is always with our clients we're working with to move to more an advisor level position, where maybe they're calling me a couple hours a month saying, hey, we got this new deal in, how would you look at this? Or, you know, some strategic thing. And so the playbook is just very simply connecting your strategic investments, your differentiators, to your sales offering so that you stand out.
Sorry to interrupt, but I have a special announcement from my new sponsor, Mainline Ventures. Imagine boosting your revenue by 5% or increasing your deal conversion by 3%. Mainline Ventures turns this into reality for your sales team. With a foundation in negotiation science and storytelling through analytics, their team of former oil and gas executives delivers bespoke sales training, enterprise deal advising, and go-to-market strategies for oilfield services and energy tech firms. Dive into the world of E&P buying decisions with our tailored oil and gas sales training designed around your live deals for instant ROI. Learn more about Mainline's track record in the oil and gas space and bring your sales game into the new frontier by visiting mainline-ventures.com. Thanks. And now back to the show.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. So do you have, I mean, can you give any examples of where this is, like companies have applied this and without getting, you know, disclosing anything sensitive, that there was actually a huge value in ROI for applying it?
Yeah, I think one more recently, and, you know, it's a relatively, you know, common oil field service. It's a heavily commoditized sector, which, to be frank, like Keith and I work best with a highly differentiated offering, but we can help things that are typically commoditized differentiate as well. And so this was kind of your typical dumb iron rental, and really paired back and did a deep audit and saw like, hey, they have this very unique competitive advantage around refurbishment and maintenance and taking, you know, being able to reuse equipment that most folks wouldn't be able to reuse. And so quickly identified, and I think this is like where Keith and my background, it'll make more sense when we talk through the process, Justin, because the first step is finding leverage. And Keith and my oil and gas background allows us to immediately find leverage because we've been operators. And so with that company, it's like, hey, there's a tremendous amount of pain on customer property. There's a tremendous amount of pain on getting crazy rebuild bills at the end of your AFE and not having cost control. So what this unique investment you have here, you need to position it around is solving those two needs because they're pressing right now. Every, you know, E&P company, right, of all this consolidation going on, everyone's trying to be as capitally efficient as possible, get OPEX down because they want to be able to pay down the debt that they may have had to take to facilitate the deal. And more importantly, to distribute dividends to increase attractiveness because companies aren't buying oil and gas, or people aren't buying oil and gas stocks like they used to, thinking I'll make the money 30 years down the road on the stock price alone. It's dividend payments, it's share buybacks, it's things like that. And so with that firm, it was kind of, hey, this is really unique. No one has it in your area. Let's create offerings around that that address this kind of pressing need that we know matters to the operator. And it, you know, has been really transformational in how they think about going to market.
Wow, dude, that's impressive. That's,
And again, I think a lot of companies, they just don't know where to look oftentimes. And then when they do find something, it's like, well, how do we actually allow, you know, build a strategy around this, then a plan that can flow to the bottom line, right? Like at the end
that's
of the
right.
day, that's right. You want to, you know, add to the bottom line, but some people don't know how to connect A to Z, which again, from someone like with you guys have that experience, it's you can quickly come up with a framework and, you know, a plan to get there. So let's get into it then. So start with the first, so it's a 5-step sort of process. Walk us through each one. And then, like I said, mentioned to the audience, in the next 5 episodes, we'll actually break each of them down. But I think it's important to give a high level overview of each one and how they all connect.
Okay. Yeah, no, totally. Our first step is really around finding leverage. It's finding leverage in your sales process, in your negotiation. And in my mind, in Keith's mind, it's really a twofold process in finding the leverage. First, and this is a common mistake I see a lot, it's recognizing when leverage is present. And what I mean by that is there are these moments when you as a sales company have this door of new leverage that you need to recognize and capitalize on. It's like when a company calls you and says, hey, we have this new rig opportunity because someone's getting run off, or hey, we're thinking about expanding here. Or, I mean, I say this all the time in my personal negotiation work. It's being, hey, Justin, we want you to take over this new responsibility within the company. Boom. That's a target to me. They're asking for something. They're being very forthright in what their needs are. I need to think about how to approach this to maximize the pie. There's also translating the leverage. And this is why this is just doing your homework. And it's why I harp so much on doing earnings calls. Like my 3 of my biggest tools are way you're capturing earnings calls. For me, the most important is the Q&A. And when I see multiple quarterly earnings calls where the same questions are getting asked, that gives me a pretty good sense of what a pressing issue within the company. So it's being systematic in the earnings calls. For me, I use a lot of AI software platforms for transcription of meetings, obviously with their consent, so I can keep really good detail on what they're telling me and kind of flag those needs. And it's organizing that information. And so that's important to find leverage, because leverage is going to come from solving their need. It's kind of common demand side selling. Like that is where you first find your leverage. It's what need can I solve for my target company? That's my entry point. And then to maximize that leverage, you have to do it against the backdrop of your competitive space. So it's, I know company A has this problem. How can I solve it? Okay, here are the 3 things I think that are unique to my company that I can solve it. Now, who do I think the competition is, and which one of these 3 things stand out most against them? Okay, there, when we do that analysis, and we get really into the weeds on this, but boom, that's leverage. Like once we've done that analysis, here's their needs. Here's the thing that you can offer that stands out to your competition. That's our leverage point. That's where we're gonna anchor and push our process into.
Nice. No, I think how would you say through a lot of the, like over the years, the people that you've talked to, do people have a hard time finding leverage? Like, is that challenging, or do most people know what the leverage is, but they just don't know what to do with it?
I think people have a hard time recognizing when leverage is present. And what sometimes happens, again, and I'll give the employment example. My call is, I do a lot of these with my ex-classmates on employment. Like the common one is, I want you to take over this new area of responsibility. Okay. Boom. That's leverage. What folks, I think, fail to do is really utilize it. And so what I mean by that is they'll agree to take on that new responsibility, and then think they'll have the conversation after around new compensation, new title, new things like that. And so I think folks just aren't aware, one, of like when that leverage point comes, identifying it and saying, okay, I have to use this moment. I have to do it before I agree to this certain thing, because then I lose it. And I think the other thing is, like on the earnings calls, it's just human nature. We're egocentric. It's hard for us to think in terms of, you know, what is the customer really caring about? And sometimes We just get bogged down in the day to day. So I think folks have a hard time. And this is with every company, Justin. Like, we work for Fortune 500 companies. I'm always surprised when I ask who reads earnings calls, the lack of hands that go up. So I think it's more of an egocentric thing. I'm not saying people are egocentric. I think we're so busy in our day to day that we don't step back and say, what's the customer's perspective? What are their pressing needs? And connecting that need to like a point of leverage.
Makes sense. All right. So now that you, assuming you found the leverage, what do you do with that? Step two.
Yeah. And I think this is the most critical, and it's what I talk most to people about. It's analyzing that leverage. It's analytically understanding what is that leverage worth. And so this requires you to put yourself in the shoes of the other side. So what would they do if they did not use your product? Who might they use, or what does their current operation, their current drilling plan, their current completion plan, their current whatever look like without your unique differentiation in it? And so you can do an analysis on it, right? I had a post not too long ago about a client who had just superior runtime above, you know, the benchmark competition based on what they thought. Well, and this is what Keith and I can help with. We know relative spread rates, things like that. So we can actually take, like, using that differentiator translates to this much added cost to the other side's business, and start there to kind of calculate, like, how much is this leverage worth? You know, I think the key thing is don't let perfection get in the way of action on this. It's perfectly fine to use estimates, you know, like, even if you don't have an idea what the spread rate is, use an estimate. Use an estimate on how much time you think you're going to save. Use an estimate on cost. The important thing is we start to create a story around that. So when you put the offer in front of the customer, they have to go back and do the calculation themselves. Like, that's the whole goal. So it's kind of finding that leverage and then thinking about that leverage through the eyes of the other side to calculate what's it worth to them. Kind of the basis of value-based selling.
Gotcha. Okay. So once you've analyzed your leverage, what do you then do? Like, I would imagine the deal comes slowly after that, right?
Yeah, so now in our mind, you're ready to start to craft the deal. The third step is craft the deal. So, you know, whatever that maximum point is typically going to be what we call our keystone issue, our top issue. But we want to create more issues. We want to have a package of issues we discuss when we go to the table. It's why I tell folks, you know, my example on the employment, you get new responsibility. Hey, pull that forward, have that issue present when you're talking about your salary, your vacation schedule, your things like that. So we always want to be using a package level negotiation, simply because if you're only negotiating one thing, Justin, if you and me are only talking price, it's going to be very contentious. The only way for me to win is for you to lose. And so we want to put more things in the pie. And then we want to use multiple offers or package-based deals. And what I mean by that is we want to show options, and we want to vary things across those options. And there's a variety of very scientific reasons why presenting options like that work. They help anchor. You seem very flexible. So you might be able to anchor at a higher price point, but you seem very accommodating because you're showing options. You move the discussion from a single issue to multiple issues. And you parse out a lot of great information, because what folks will typically do is, say, I like this in option A, I like this in option B, I like this in option C. Boom, you've gotten a lot of information about what really matters to the whoever you're on the other side of the table from.
Gotcha. And so with that, so what you're saying is ultimately when you're crafting a deal, you like having options for the buyer is critical. It gives you opportunities, I guess, to negotiate at that point, right?
That's right, because you're varying things, you're trading things off, and you're giving comparison. Like, one of the key psychological things for folks to make decisions is to have some comparisons and to understand the trade-offs. And so you're articulating that across the offer, and you're also connecting it to a story. And so because we started at the leverage point, right, we know the pressing issue that we're solving for the customer. Now we're building the deal from. We also know the story. And I harp on this all the time. It's stories, not data, move people. You can utilize your data to tell the most compelling story, but right, you really want to say, you know, you're helping reduce your capital execution risk on your 2024 program by saving X million dollars over, you know, the year or whatever. And it's kind of building that story out. And so options are a critical part of that.
Gotcha. So once you've crafted the deal, have multiple options, how do you then go to actually deploying something like what you've actually crafted?
Yeah. So now we have our offer. Now it's thinking about going in front of the customer, the target, and delivering that offer. I tell people all the time, our advice is always to get away from these long, drawn out presentations that for the most part, I mean, all the clients kind of look the same. So we want very succinct, and we call like an upside down pyramid. We want to start very broad, and we really want to start with the other side. We want to start with who we're going in to sell to and the pressing issue we're there to solve. So I always like, you know, a slide with a couple quotes from the senior executives from the earnings calls, and then maybe some notes on, you know, what you view their key issues. And I like to start with that. I like it for a variety of reasons. It elicits a lot of conversation. No one's going to disagree with the CEO, you know, saying that CapEx reduction or whatever they're talking about is not a focus area. You start there, and then you very succinctly go from what the key challenge is for them and then how you're uniquely positioned to solve it, maybe three or four slides, and then to your offer. The other key thing we tell folks is now you can take that and scale it for the different stakeholders that you might be meeting with. Like I would say nowadays, Justin, you probably see it on your side. You're not just dealing with one stakeholder. You're dealing with IT, drilling, finance, completions, maybe to get something sold in. You could take that and change it across. Like it, you might be solving the same problem, but you might talk about it differently with each group and what their piece of that problem is. And then, you know, we always say we keep it at a package level discussion. So we put those packages together. Folks are going to try to cherry pick. We want to parse that information out, but we want to tell them, hey, we thought about these as distinctly packaged offerings. We're happy to contemplate a new offering that incorporates these things. We'll come back to you with that.
Gotcha. No, that's something that, again, like being in the business development side for the last 10 years, having options, it was never something that I'd really thought of. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, here's the price, take it. And, leave yourself a little wiggle room if someone's trying to beat you down on price to get you closer to your competitor. But having options and getting creative on what you're willing to offer, I think, even in itself, is a slightly different, you know, it could be a differentiator. And if I would imagine, and you could elaborate on this, but if I'm an engineer or if I'm in supply chain, I'm looking at different options. I mean, I think there comes a point where if there's too many options, then you're kind of like, well, this is confusing and I'm wasting too much energy trying to figure out what the hell this all is. But even if you keep it simple enough and you craft the right message and you make it digestible for the particular audience or buyers that you're doing, then I think they're like, oh, they're actually putting some thought into this. Do you ever get to a point where people are like, oh, these are too many options, they're trying to bedazzle me? You know, like what would be your response? Because honestly, I think that's something that's wrong. I was like, well, you give me all these options, there's something I'm not following, and I feel like you're trying to pull a fast one on me. Like, does that, and not to undermine the strategy, but I'm assuming that might come to mind.
Yeah, I haven't ever seen it, but I will say we're very structured in how we do it. There's a lot of psychological research that says, you know, people can really handle like 3 to 9 things varying when it comes to decision-making. So we don't want to have a crazy amount of issues. And frankly, my preference is to have 2 options. There's some cases where I'll do a third. I like to do a third if I'm betting. So what I mean by that is the third option might look a lot like an option with just an added bet to it, so it's not too complicated. A key part, Justin, is, and I tell folks this all the time, you want to see people when you deliver the offer. We do not encourage email sending these things. You know, we say get in person if you can, at a minimum Zoom, so that you can control and be there and deliver it and make sure everything's understood. And my point is always to folks, like if folks won't take a 30-minute meeting with you, it's for you to deliver the offer. I don't think it's worth your time pursuing, because what's the likelihood, unless you have such a great relationship, that you're going to win that work if they won't give you 30 minutes of your time to get in front of you and explain it.
Yeah. But yeah, I agree. I've not seen that. And we try to be really structured so we don't get that, hey, you're confusing me, you're pulling, you know, pulling a fast one, that type of thing.
Yeah. No, it, I mean, and I appreciate you adding to that. And you know, you, and I remember you saying this, is like, if someone's not going to meet with you to present your offer, a lot of times it's, you know, they're just either looking for pricing, looking for, you know, market validation, whatever. I mean, a lot of times now it is tough to get in front of people. They'd rather just, and especially if you're dealing with like these large companies where you have to submit your RFP through like a portal or something. But to your point, like hopefully there's been at least meetings leading up to it. And even during the RFP process, they'll, a lot of times they won't even meet with you. They'll like, if you have any questions, email this portal and then we'll blast it out to the people. And so I think it's still important to try.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, depending on how the RFP is structured, they purposely don't allow you to go in there, probably because they know that you're going to go in there and negotiate and try and give yourself and put yourself in a position to win the work, right?
100%. And we do a lot of procurement stuff too. And our number one tool is RFPs. So like we would give that advice back. We could do a whole nother episode on RFP responses, Justin. Like we have a very prescriptive method for doing that. But I would tell folks, and I tell them like, hey, even if you're going to email it, if at a minimum you have to email it, get online, create a Loom, do a video of you presenting and walking through it, send it to them. You can see if they can view it. Like you have some that at least you're trying to control the message.
Yeah.
You can see if they click it and view it. Like, yeah, I mean, I'm a big proponent of that if you can't get in front of them. And again, it helps you stand out and differentiate, in my opinion. So that would be another advice I would have.
That's actually really creative. I never thought of that. So last step would be what?
Close the deal. It's thinking about close before you even at the deal table. Our number one thing is we always want to plan concession. That's why analyzing that leverage is really important. We don't want to start at your walkaway point. We want to build some fat in where we're conceding at the end of the day. Variety research around this, you know, where it really boils down to is it's a very relationship enhancing thing to do.
Can you give a, like a dummy example of what you mean by conceding? Like what, like make up like just a hypothetical situation where you're conceding.
Yeah. So say we do this analysis, Justin, I'm coming in to do this big project for you. I did the leverage calculation on what it's worth to you. And I came up with my goal price to be $50,000, my high-end goal price, $50,000. I've done my analysis on my side with my people, and I know it's going to cost me $25,000 to do it, right? That's my cost, right? So I might start at $45,000 with the intent that seed, I'm gonna be happy at 35, where I know I'm still making 10 on the product. And I'm just giving numbers as an example. So it's doing that analysis ahead of time to say, here's where I'm gonna try to the goal. But if I concede, here's what I'm conceding to, and I've done the analysis to show I'm still good there. What a lot of folks do is they'll start at, you know, their cost plus a markup, right? So they'll go 25, you know, call it 30, right? 20% markup. And then concede off of the, and then, you know, that doesn't give them any room to concede. They get pressed on price. Next thing they're doing work for the sake of doing work. And so it's just thinking through, okay, here's my top end goal. Here's where I'm going to come at. Here's where I'm going to concede to if I get pushed back. And we want to get pushed back. Last like little bit I'll say is, you know, we say you're not negotiating till you hear no. You know, a lot of times if you bring pricing in, they say, yeah, it looks great. You're kind of like, well, shoot, I didn't do the right analysis. I left some money on the table. So we want that to be in mind. I am cognizant that a lot of OFS firms have low margins. So in that case, I want to concede by adding a new issue into the deal. Maybe it's something, you know, that's important to them that you hold out of the initial offer. And so you say, hey, we'll throw this thing in if it gets the deal done. That's another kind of concession strategy from our end.
Interesting.
And then the last thing I'll say, it's making sure you're thinking through what are you going to get pushed back on and how are you going to stay on message so you don't just immediately concede on price. And so that's kind of how we look at closing the deal.
Yeah, no, man, that's well, I'm excited to dive into each step again, selfishly, as someone in sales and business development. I mean, my role is somewhat changed, but I'll always be in sales. You know, once a salesman, always a salesman. So, and for the audience out there, if any one of these things pique your interest, reach out to Ian. Again, just a wealth of knowledge. Make sure to connect with Mainline Ventures on LinkedIn with Ian and Keith. Looking forward to the next episode. Ian, again, really appreciate your time. Congrats on all the success. Please subscribe, leave a review. Connect with the Myers Brothers and Mainline Ventures and tune in to the next episode where we'll talk about step one, which again is finding the leverage. All right, folks, take care for now. Always remember that everyone deserves access to energy, and we is greater than me. Thanks, everybody.